David Boies, and I represent the plaintiffs below, the appellants in this court.
Okay, we discussed this case for a few minutes before this session, and we decided it would be more helpful to us if, rather than discussing the relation between this case and our two previous opinions, you would just tell us, you know, preferably in words of one syllable, what is the evidence that you believe creates a tribal issue as to whether there's a cartel here?
First, Your Honor, let me cite some prior decisions by Judge Koukouras, because I think that sets out some of that information. And that is found at pages 46 to 57 of the appendix and pages 63 to 68 of the appendix. At pages 46 to 57 of the appendix, Judge Koukouras, in originally denying the manufacturer's motion for summary judgment, sets forth a significant amount of evidence of the conspiracy. And at pages 63 through 68 of the appendix, Judge Koukouras sets forth a considerable amount of information that goes to the issue as to whether there are, in fact, different elasticities between independent pharmacies and the so-called favored purchasers. As I think this court has recognized, and I think the evidence makes clear, there is price discrimination here. That price discrimination was evidence of market power, although the source of that market power is obviously one of the questions the court is asking. And second, the chargeback system that was adopted was, as this court found in 1999, adopted, at least there was evidence from which a jury could conclude, that it was adopted collectively and not individually. For example, some of that evidence was the evidence at pages 3347 to 3348 of the record, where a representative of one of the wholesaler defendants comes back from a meeting in April of 1985, reports to his superiors that the PMC, the Pharmaceutical Marketing Committee of the National Wholesalers Druggist Association, had concluded that there was a, quote, consensus not to bid to retail buying groups. You also have...
Which witness was this?
I'm sorry, what?
Which witness, sorry?
This was Mr. Dammert.
This was Dammert.
This was Dammert. You also have, Your Honor, the testimony by Mr. Sarrett, S-A-R-A-T, where he testifies, and this is at 2652 to 2656 of the appendix, that manufacturers were asked not to sell to retail buying groups. You also have, for example, a Seba Geigy, one of the manufacturer's defendants, memorandum in 1986, which is at 3027 of the appendix. Quote, most of the major wholesalers I've discussed this matter with all agree on the fact that brand name manufacturers do not have to encourage further proliferation of these groups by bidding to them. The issue of how to stop what was called diversion to retail pharmacies, that is, arbitrage, was a subject of NWDA meetings that included both wholesalers and manufacturers, both in 1984, was in November of 1984, that's 3036 of the appendix, as well as in April of 1985, that's the one that Mr. Dammert was testifying about. We have put in...
Now, why does this material show that there is a conspiracy with the manufacturers?
There are two or maybe three levels, Your Honor. First is, was the chargeback system adopted collectively by the wholesalers? That is, was it collective action? This court both in 97 and 99 said yes to that issue based on the evidence that was in the record. And certainly the kind of evidence that Mr. Dammert and others have given. We put in 49 affidavits from people who were both former employees of wholesalers, pharmacists, former representatives of favored purchasers, that throughout the period there was this discussion between wholesalers and manufacturers. Now, our briefing really does not go in detail to the issue as to whether or not the manufacturers engaged in a conspiracy. That was because this court's 1997 opinion held that there was adequate evidence to go to the jury on that issue, and Judge Koukouras, even after the class trial, held the same thing. This arises because Judge Koukouras said that the class trial was an intervening event, and looking at the class evidence and concluding, contrary to what we think the facts are and contrary to what he himself had said earlier, that we made the same basic evidence arguments that the class had made, he concluded that because the class had lost, we should lose on the wholesaler issue.
I don't really care what he said, because he granted summary judgment, so we don't defer to the district judge, but I'm just kind of lost. What is your evidence that that this is a cartel with the... I mean, the problem you have is that we know that each of the drug manufacturers has the ability and the incentive to engage in price discrimination because they have these patented goods, non-fungible, and, you know, a big expense in the drug business is the research. That's a fixed cost, so you're going to have discrimination. Can't have sell at marginal cost, not remunerative. So you're going to have this discrimination. And if the wholesalers merely facilitate the individual efforts of manufacturers to exercise their lawful right of price discrimination, there's no offense. So I take it what you're trying to show is that these manufacturers are collusively engaged in price discrimination, and the wholesalers are part of this conspiracy. Isn't that your theory?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
So what's the evidence?
Well, Your Honor, there are two problems with that question. First, I think that question is, at this point, law of the case here.
Law of the case is just a presumption anyway. And we said to you, we are quite happy to take a fresh look at your case, the opt-outs case,
right,
and not say we decided for you or against you in our previous opinion.
Right.
So we just like to know, what's the evidence that, you know, what's the evidence that would entitle you to a trial to try to prove that there is this conspiracy?
And by this conspiracy, you mean the conspiracy between the manufacturers?
Yes.
Now, that is an issue that I would respectfully suggest to the court, that there was no suggestion ought to be briefed to this court in connection with this appeal.
But I thought, I mean, you lay tremendous emphasis on economic evidence. Well, no, it's not just economic. The evidence which suggests that because pharmacies have the kind of bargaining power that hospitals and HMOs have, that therefore the fact that they don't get discounts must show that the manufacturers have gotten together and said, look, we've got to draw the line somewhere. We're not going to allow these pharmacies to get discounts, because then everyone is getting discounts. We're not making our monopoly profit. So I thought that's what that evidence is about. It's about showing this conspiracy,
right,
among the manufacturers. And that, I thought, meant that, you know, what you're trying to show is there is with the conspiracy among the manufacturers, which the wholesalers then joined and became the cat's paws to enforce this manufacturer's cartel.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's right. And
so what's the evidence? Okay,
well,
there's your economic evidence.
Well,
you have this
from the economic
bargaining power. Is there something else? Or?
Well, first from the economic evidence. There's evidence in the record that pharmacists are at least as able, if not more able, to so-called shift market share as the so-called favored purchasers. There is extensive record evidence of that fact. There is evidence from affidavits. Mr. Drow at 2784 of the appendix, Mr. Kirkland at 2854 of the appendix, Mr. Brooklyn at 2714 of the appendix, Mr. Berman at 2719 of the appendix, and Mr. Martin at 2863 of the appendix. There is evidence that to the extent discounts are given to favored purchasers, it is not given on the basis of formulary. That is, it is not given on the basis of excluding. The majority of the favored purchasers do not have a formulary. In addition, we put in a number of affidavits into the record by people who operate so-called dual pharmacies. One serves a nursing home, one serves the public. They get different prices, and the dual pharmacy operators say, we don't do anything different. We don't exclude, we don't have a closed formulary, we don't do anything different to get that kind of information. And there's a whole series of those affidavits that we put into the record. Third, we put in the record the evidence from the manufacturers and the wholesalers themselves that demonstrate that the retail pharmacies can move market share. We put in doctors' testimony. Abramowitz.
I'm not sure, Mr. Boyce, how this helps to demonstrate the existence of a conspiracy at the manufacturing level.
Well, as this
seems to say, if what you're saying about the elasticities is true, then the manufacturer's behavior is irrational, but it's irrational either individually or if they're conspiring, because they're not setting their price where marginal cost equals marginal revenue. To demonstrate that people are behaving irrationally is not to demonstrate conspiracy.
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest that it is not irrational if they are behaving collectively. If they are collusively...
Why would it be rational if they're colluding?
Because if they are colluding, what they are able to do is to keep the price higher for all of them than they would be able to do if they reduce the prices.
If, as you say, the elasticities for retail pharmacies are the same as for somebody else, and you make it hospitals, then a rational monopolist would charge the same price to both, not different prices.
Your Honor, as this court pointed out in its 1997 opinion, that's not necessarily so, because if you have a place where competition exists, like with the hospital, and you want to draw the line so it does not extend into what was at that point by far the greatest part of the business, which is retail pharmacies, then it makes sense if you can do it collectively to prevent that kind of discounting, because while any individual is better off if market share is shifted to that individual's product, collectively they're worse off because the market share is going to somebody else, and all you've done is bring down the price that they are collectively getting. So I think it is irrational if they are operating independently, but it is rational if they're operating collectively. And I think, as this court pointed out in its 1999 opinion, if you can show situations in which the elasticities are different, but the conduct is the same, that is some evidence that there is collusion. And for example...
But would you say that that evidence by itself would be enough to warrant a reasonable jury in finding there was a conspiracy?
Well, Your Honor, I think in the context of the parallel... practices and uniform practices and the statements that they were defining a class of trade, if what you find is that defining that class of trade, separating one class of trade from another class of trade, is not based on the elasticities, I think it would be enough. However, we have much more in the record.
OK. Okay, what's the best more that you have?
Well, I would say, and I don't mean to avoid listing everything, but I would say the best more is actually what is stated by Judge Koukouras in the record at 46 to 57. In addition to that, I would suggest to the court the kind of document like at 3027, the Ciba Geigy document, which indicates the discussions with the wholesalers about not bidding to buying groups. It is the testimony and the evidence in the record that this court also referred to in its 1997 opinion. The precise citations to all of those elements of the record are not citations that, as I say, I have in detail, because that is an issue that was not brought up on appeal. That is the issue of the manufacturer's conspiracy. One of the things that this court had said, and I understand that this court is always free to say something differently, but one of the things that this court had said in 1997, when it reversed summary judgment for one of the defendants, DuPont Merck, is that there was enough evidence in the record there of a manufacturer's conspiracy. That was not reopened. Even Judge Koukouras did not permit that to be reopened below. So we've come here really, and the briefs, I think, on both sides have directed it to the wholesalers' participation. And with respect to that, I think that the evidence is of collective action and of their knowledge of what the manufacturers were doing.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Roche?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'd like to just dive right in and address the question that the court put to Mr. Boyd first, and then run down through the points he made and try and respond to them. You asked what evidence creates a triable issue of fact as to us. And I think that the analysis there properly begins with an analysis of the claim that's been made against us by the opt-outs. And I'll simply remind the court that that claim, according to the opt-outs, representation to the district court when they brought us in 5 years after they brought the cases against the manufacturers, was that their claim was identical to the claim that the class plaintiffs were making against us. Namely, that our development and implementation of the chargeback system was simply part and parcel of a conspiracy with the manufacturers to deny discounts to retail buying groups. That's their claim. That's the linchpin of their case against us. The analysis, I think, then properly moves to what's the legal standard that applies to evaluation of that claim. And that, I think, is clear, is the standard that was set out by the Supreme Court in the Monsanto case. They have to create a triable issue of fact that demonstrates that in developing and implementing the chargeback system, we acted with a conscious commitment to a common scheme designed to achieve an illegal objective. Now, it doesn't matter whether they create a triable issue as to whether or not the manufacturers conspired or had that objective. As to us, they have to demonstrate that as to us. Did we have that conscious commitment? And it also doesn't matter, quite frankly, whether they demonstrate that there's a triable issue that the chargeback system operated to inhibit us from engaging in arbitrage. This court addressed that specifically at oral argument last time and in the opinion in Brand Name 2. You'll recall that at the oral argument, Judge Easterbrook observed that, and you've just observed that this morning as well, Judge Posner, that manufacturers...
Two observant fellows.
If I may.
Carry on.
That the manufacturers, particularly those with market power, don't like discrimination, but that does not prove a conspiracy. And it also...
No, they like discrimination. They don't like discounts.
Well, they don't like discounts, exactly.
Like uniformly high prices.
But they also don't like arbitrage. And frankly, that's something that the court held as a matter of law last time around, because you said it was obvious that the system operated to inhibit arbitrage by us. But you held as a matter of law that didn't create a triable issue of fact as to conspiracy. And that makes good sense. I mean, there are lots of tools for arbitrage, particularly post-Sylvania, including customer restrictions, et cetera. And those are not any evidence of an illegal conspiracy. So let me run down what the evidence here shows. First,
suppose the wholesalers knew that the manufacturers were conspiring. There's some evidence. You can debate over the strength of their evidence. Suppose there's some evidence of that manufacturer's conspiracy, and your clients know about that. They know that. They know that some of this price discrimination is exclusively adopted. And they say, great, well, we'll help them. You know, we'll share. The better they do, the better we do. We'll be their agents to prevent arbitrage, which would destroy their cartel.
Okay, can I first address that in two parts, please? The claim is that in developing and implementing the chargeback system, we knew. There is no triable issue of fact as to that claim. Contrary to the representations that were made to this court back in Brand Name 1, the trial record established that, in fact, the chargeback system was developed and implemented before the advent of retail buying groups in the mid-1980s, and that regardless of what the manufacturer's intent in that respect was, our objective in that regard was to serve at that time hospitals who were getting discounts but wanted the benefit of instantaneous discounts and wholesaler service. And the record in this case incorporates that trial record. Not only that, but the plaintiff's expert in this case, Dr. Leffler, confirms that those core facts are true. So there is absolutely no evidence that at the time we developed and implemented the chargeback system, we knew...
Why did the chargeback system result in faster discounts?
Because what happens is that we charge pursuant to contracts that we have with the discount recipient, we charge the discount recipient the amount that the discount recipient has negotiated with the manufacturer. That's why there's a chargeback. That's lower than the cost of goods sold that we have. And so we charge back the difference to the manufacturer. That's the reason for the chargeback. It is an extremely efficient system, and for those customers who are getting discounts, it is the most effective and efficient mechanism for getting them those discounts. It is, in other words, it is a very pro-competitive, pro-customer mechanism. So, number one, there is no triable issue on this record that with respect to the core claim that they make, which is at the time we developed and implemented the system, we knew about the conspiracy because the record establishes without any triable issue that there was no conspiracy at that time. It predated the alleged conspiracy. Now, let me turn to the second aspect of your question. First of all, I don't believe that there is a triable issue that any of us knew later that the manufacturers were conspiring. Mr. Boyce has gone down a whole litany of things which he suggests show that. And if I could just spend a minute on that, and then I want to turn to your question as a matter of law, if I may, Judge Posner. First, Mr. Dammert. He talked about Mr. Dammert. Well, you'll recall Mr. Dammert was a witness at the trial. And at that time, he was advanced to this court in brand name two as being evidence of the conspiracy. And you wrote in brand name two about Mr. Dammer. And you said his testimony has nothing to do with this conspiracy. At most, what it shows is that there was a conspiracy among the wholesalers with respect to their service fees. It has nothing to do with the issues in this case. Mr. Dammer is not evidence of a conspiracy in this case. Mr. Sarnak, representations were made to you in brand name one about Mr. Sarnak's testimony. As it turned out, the class plaintiffs didn't put Sarnak on at the trial, and for very good reason. His testimony is in this record now, together with testimony that we took from him after brand name one, and it doesn't resemble what you were told about it then, and or for that matter, what you were told about it today. All that it doesn't suggest that there were any communications between us and manufacturers at all. It relates to communications between Mr. Sarnak's company, which was General Drug, and a couple of local Chicago wholesalers, none of whom are wholesaler defendants in this case. Mr. Sarnak's testimony does not create a tribal issue. The SEBA Geigy memo, that was submitted by the class plaintiffs at trial. It was excluded by Judge Krikoris, and for very good reason. It was rank hearsay. It didn't identify any declarant at all. With respect to the NWDA documents that were mentioned by counsel, they talk about how can we stop arbitrage. Well, we've already covered that. An intention to stop arbitrage in and of itself is not even evidence of a conspiracy among the manufacturers, much less among us. And finally, he talks about the 49 affidavits that were submitted that demonstrate that the retailers were able to move market share to the same extent that the discount recipients were. And the short answer to that one is that those 49 affidavits represent exactly one hundredth of 1% of the more than 50,000 retailers that their so-called Mississippi study says existed in the United States. There's absolutely no suggestion in those affidavits that retailers as a class could move market share, exclude brand name products to the same extent that the discount recipients could. And certainly no evidence that would suggest that was so apparent, so obvious, that we knew that the manufacturers were conspiring. Now let me turn to the question that you've asked as a matter of law, because I think I'm on my last 30 seconds. I would like to assume hypothetically, that we knew sometime after the chargeback system was in place, that we discovered somehow that the manufacturers were in fact conspiring. What does that do as a matter of law? The plaintiffs have not suggested to you a single case that would require that we abandon the chargeback system in those circumstances. And why not? Because it makes no sense. This is not a case of a device that is purely a conspiracy facilitating device. It undeniably has very efficient and pro-customer benefits. And under those circumstances, it flies in the face of, for example, broadcast music from the Supreme Court, the White case in this circuit, where you're dealing with mechanisms which arguably can be facilitating devices on the one hand, but have pro-competitive efficiency benefits on the other. And those cases are clear that you do not, that's not grist for a per se violation.
Well, what if you were engaged in the business of selling scrambler phones and a cartel came to you and said, you know, we really want to have secure communications in our business. We have a lot of trade secrets, and also we have a conspiracy. And, of course, you want to have conspiratorial communication very secret. So can you have really excellent scrambler phones that you can sell us, and you say yes, we're delighted to do so. Wouldn't you be an aider and abettor or a co-conspirator or something as a cartelist?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I honestly don't, but I don't think that's the situation. I mean, there are lots and lots of other alternatives to which customers can turn for their scrambler phone. But even if that were so, that's not our case. Here we're talking about as we were in broadcast music, as we are in Wade, we're talking about a very specific device which has, there are really no alternatives to that device that are as efficient. Not as efficient. There are alternatives, such as manufacturer rebates, et cetera, but none that deliver the benefits to customers that this does. And that's all I'm talking about.
Well, your basic argument is the chargeback, the recipient of the discount gets the discount immediately when he buys the goods, rather than having to, you know, write a letter to the manufacturer asking for a rebate. That is
one part of my argument. There are undeniably those benefits, but I don't want to leave the podium without stressing that I do believe that's a hypothetical, because I don't believe that there's any evidence in this record that creates a triable issue of fact that we in fact subsequently, it was so obvious that the manufacturers were conspiring that we subsequently discovered that, and that we continued to use the chargeback system with that knowledge. But if that's what happened, as I say, I don't think that's risk for a per se violation, and as your honors have pointed out before, that's what's pleaded here. Not a rule of reason violation where you balance the pro-competitive against the anti-competitive. They pleaded a per se violation, and I don't think that the record in this case comes close to meeting that standard.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Roche. And
thank
Mr.
you.
Boyce, we'll give you two more minutes, although your time is.
Thank you, Your Honor. We do not accept that the chargeback system was completed before the conspiracy, and indeed even on page 11 of their brief, they say that the chargeback system became essentially complete, whatever that means, in the mid-1980s, at the time that they themselves say that the buying groups are being developed. Mr. Fugate, in his affidavit, that's at 2764, paragraph 7 of that affidavit, Mr. Ransom, in his affidavit at 3078, paragraph 10 in particular of that, as well as some of the other things cited in our brief, talk about conversations, discussions between the wholesalers and the manufacturers. You have a situation in which, with respect to certain drugs, the so-called AB drugs that we talk about in our brief, the pharmacists have the ability in 18 states to simply shift from one drug to another without even calling the manufacturer. There is no discount given, even in those 18 states, to pharmacies with respect to those drugs. You have a situation in which you have the testimony that 68% of the pharmacists' requests to doctors to change the prescription, even with respect to non-AB drugs, are followed. Still, no discounts. That is exactly the kind of uniform refusal to give discounts that, in the context of the other evidence of Mr. Ransom, Mr. Fucate, Mr. Serrett, who doesn't just talk. I asked the court to look at the record that we cited to the court. They are not talking just about conversations among wholesalers. Although even if they were, you're still talking about a horizontal agreement among wholesalers to adopt the chargeback system. What the court below found, what this court found even in the 1999 opinion, affirming the class result. So what you have is a situation in which you have horizontal competitors, the wholesalers, collectively agreeing to adopt this program that is designed, as this court has repeatedly said, to prevent arbitrage. The question is whether or not that violates the antitrust laws under all the facts.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Boyd, Mr. Roche.